Clubhouse.
Imagine me and you, I do. I think about you daily.
Welcome back to Film Reviews. My name is Mike. Tonight we're talking about Laurel Canyon, A Place in Time, Part 2. It was directed by Allison Elwood. Joining me again for Part 2, the married duo, Sheila from Pop Culture Review, and her husband, John. How are you guys doing? Welcome back.
Hey, good. Thanks for having us back.
It's a pleasure. Our pleasure.
It's been a whole week, guys. I feel like the whole music scene has changed.
Drastically.
From the end of Part 1 to what we had in Part 2 tonight. Quick takes. What was your feeling for this wrap-up installment versus Part 1? Did you like it better? Like it less? Did you like it the same? Take it as a whole? What were your takes? What did you think, John?
This one was definitely darker. As I said in the first podcast, how the MTV or any of the documentaries, there's always a rise and a fall of the artists. And it just seemed like this one was more the fall of the artists, less positive. But it was very well done.
It was almost all fall, I feel like. Even right. The people who were rising, you know, it was, you know, rising for a different reason than our first wave Laurel Canyon denizens did. How about you, Sheila? What was your take, this part two versus part one?
I like the content of it, you know, just exploring sort of how Laurel Canyon as an area wound its way through and kind of ran its course. Definitely felt a lot more somber to me. You know, we touched on that a little bit. There's a lot more death. There's a lot more destruction. And just how the music scene even changed within this small microcosm of time, just how everything changed was just, you know, sort of, I guess, the flip side of like the happy-go-lucky part one that we saw. So this was definitely its darker, you know, sort of evil twin.
You know, it was really shocking to see the drastic change, not only in the people who were living in Laurel Canyon and the people making music there, but just the entire music scene, the way it changed. And you would think, if you didn't know, that like 10 years had gone by, so drastic was the change. And you're literally talking about a year, 18 months at most, and it was virtually unrecognizable from the type of music, you know, the folk music going into early folk rock to like the folk rock that had kind of evolved into like rock and roll, like what would be light rock for the 70s, but not really terribly recognizable. You know, the Eagles and the Byrds, Mr. Tambourine Man, are not a lot alike. Were you surprised, Sheila, at drastic change in music in so short a time?
Absolutely. It went from, you know, a lot of folksy, Joni Mitchell, you know, the Byrds, as you mentioned, you know, Crosby, Stills, and Nash, very, not so much the rock and roll part. And then all of a sudden, you know, bang, you move into the Eagles, which is nowhere in the vicinity, but you know, they all kind of sprung out of the same area. So I was pretty surprised at how quickly it changed.
How about you, John? What stood out for you as the biggest change across the board? I mean, there was the scene change, the players were largely different. Even the ones who were around from like the first episode that were still maybe living in Laurel Canyon were really not, they were really fading by this point, versus just the kind of music. You know, is this more the kind of music that you were talking about last episode that shaped, that kind of shaped your habits and your likes?
None of that really came as a surprise. Usually music is very circular. What I mean by that, it seems like every decade things fade out and the new genre fades in from the 60s to the 70s. You know, I guess the Eagles would be the bridge, if you will, to the 70s, getting into more of the Eagles definitely had more of a rock and roll backbone to it. Even though it was still country-ish, folky, they definitely put a rock tone to it. I wasn't shocked by it, to tell you the truth. You know, just like when the 70s came in, you had the Zeppelins, the Black Sabbaths, you know, and then the 80s with the hair rock, and then the 90s with the grunge. It's kind of the way of music. You know, it seems like every decade, the next wave comes in.
You're absolutely right. In the kind of the same way that neighborhoods change over time.
Of course.
You know, like you think about like Soho in Manhattan in New York City, you know, used to be this artist colony of bohemians. And now it's, you know, home to some of the most expensive retail stores in the country. Sure. And not over a long period of time, it had that kind of change. You know, we saw through examining Laurel Canyon as a place in time, It also went through that change. But again, I think I was not shocked at the change because I knew it was coming. You know, a change was coming. I think I was more surprised at how fast it happened. I didn't realize the changeover was so rapid. The difference between the early 1969 to the end of 19, and this takes us through 70 through like 74-ish when Mama Cass dies. Yeah, I think that's what really threw me off. Let's talk about the doc itself and the way it was set up. This was directed by Allison Elwood, who did part one also, and it still relied heavily on showing us footage with voiceover interviews. But I felt it was different, though. I felt like this was much more segmented or episodic. Part one seemed to go from really like person to person in the canyon. Part two seemed to be defined more by the events going on at the time. You know, we start with the arrival of Jackson Browne, and well, Jim Ladd, the classic LA DJ, really introduces us today. You know, we go from Jackson Browne, but then we really go from like events. We go to, you know, Altamont. We go to the Manson murders, and then we go to the Altamont, you know, the anti-Woodstock. And then you get into like the really dark stuff with idols from part one, Jim Morrison, Cass Elliot dying. What style did you like more, Sheila? Did you like this more classic narrative of here's a story, and then we're going to this story, and then to this story? Or did you not see a change? Am I making that up?
No, I definitely saw the change, and it did feel more episodic. You know, it was more about moving to, well, this happened, and this is sort of the reaction to it. You know, it opens with Jim Ladd talking about the upheaval that was happening in the United States, and I feel that this documentary, this episode of this, you know, two-parter really kind of followed that kind of upheaval, that disjointed kind of feeling that was going on in the country at the time. He talked about like the moon landing. He talked about Vietnam. He talked about the sort of the aftermath of Woodstock, you know, the assassinations that happened in 1968 with Martin Luther King. So I kind of feel like this followed that kind of like confused and, you know, where are we going to kind of end up kind of feeling, and, you know, talking about sort of like the dissolution of the folk rock system that had kind of grown up around Laurel Canyon. Like, whereas episode one to me felt very seamless, this felt a little bit more, this happened, here's what happened around that, then this happened, and here's what happened around that. It was more like isolated stories to me.
Yeah, I mean, even though we still had people going in and out of people's houses and bands breaking up and then new bands rising from that, it felt different to me too. Don, did you notice a difference in how it was delivered? And if so, did this segment of, we're going to talk about what was going on in the world and Laurel Canyon here, and then we're going to go to this thing, and then we're going to introduce drugs, and then it was that versus part one, or did it all seem kind of the same to you?
Obviously, there was a big difference between one and two. Although artists take in what is happening around them, they use it for inspiration to create, you know? So I definitely think bringing that to the viewer's attention, what was going on in society, not only society, in Laurel Canyon, I think that was very important. I do. I'm sure many of the artists wrote about it in their songs, and they used it as inspiration.
I mean, well, for sure. I mean, we saw what Neil Young writing Ohio, right, in the aftermath of the Kent State riots, and Joni Mitchell writing Woodstock. I thought it was funny. This is one of the things I really enjoy most when I tell people about Laurel Canyon and I pitch it to them. I'm gonna talk about all the things I didn't know, all like the little nuggets. And I think it's great that Joni Mitchell writes this classic song about Woodstock that became the song, as they say in this doc here. But didn't go. You know, she just observed it from the canyon, you know, from the hills, from the Hollywood Hills. I thought that was kind of funny. How about, Sheila, picking up on what John said, is this a useful way to look at history? I mean, I know you like music, but if you were trying to say, you know, show Luke what was going on in the country when he was older, and you're trying to educate him about this time, is this an approach that you think is useful to take to show someone? If we're talking about who is this good to watch?
Yeah, I do, because, you know, we touched on in the last episode that music is so pivotal that, you know, you can hear a song and you can be transported back 20, 25 years to a good or a bad time in your life. And just like the chords, the vibe of the music, everything just kind of brings you back. So the same thing with music. Music tells a story. So, you know, what better way to kind of show what's going on than, you know, hey, you know, there was this war called Vietnam. Let me play you some songs that kind of tell you about that, because it's a good way to say, well, here's what this lyric means. For certain groups of people, maybe for a little kid, it might be a little bit more of a palatable way to start understanding it. Like, for instance, I did not know that Riders on the Storm was about the Manson murders. I learned that from this documentary. I will now use that as a tidbit going forward.
I thought that was the coolest thing when they start playing that song is so iconic for me. I mean,
I
the Doors
love
as a
that
whole.
Song.
And as soon as they, the keyboard parts start coming in, I was like, oh yeah. And then they start talking about the Manson murders. I was all in. I was leaning forward, chin out over my chest, like leaning forward at the TV, you know, really engaged in what we were seeing.
And it just makes the song so much creepier now. Like, I mean, the song's great. Like, don't get me wrong. But like now knowing sort of the inspiration for it, it just makes it a little bit more, the strung out chords and things like that. It's just like, ooh. Goosebumps.
I mean, that's one of the first iconic things. After we move past Jackson Browne and how he kind of came, I love David Crosby saying that he was just too pretty to make it until he grows that really wicked mustache and he looks like, the mustache didn't work for me.
No.
So they spend a lot of time with him and then he becomes kind of this guru to this second wave, what they were referred to a couple times as the second wave of the Laurel Canyon citizens. John, do you know a lot about the Manson murders? Was this revelatory to realize how close it was and how entangled it was with this music scene? I mean, they seem about as different from each other as possible.
I have to be honest, I didn't. I found that ironic that, you know, they had this really a paradise, an artistic paradise, if you will. And then all of a sudden they had this, I don't know what you would call it, you know, this monstrous event happened with the Manson murders. And it's all within, I mean, how big is Laurel Canyon, you know, would you say?
I mean, it seems like it's like four blocks,
right,
you know, in like the hills. Not terribly big.
So
the murders actually happened, I just jotted it down, it was a quarter mile from Laurel Canyon.
Close enough. It's amazing how this large of a degree of events happened. You know, fantastic paradise of music writing and collaboration. And then, you know, here comes the extreme murders.
You know, in the first episode, someone makes a point of saying that Laurel Canyon was such an enclave. It was so closed off, except for going out to like the Troubadour. It was just this real closed off place that they were late to a lot of the counterculture stuff. Eventually they came to define the counterculture, but they were actually, as artists, were late to the revolution, to the start of it. And then the Manson murders really affected me in here because it was almost like the world was literally knocking on their door, you know, almost like they couldn't ignore it anymore. When you hear David Crosby saying he went out and bought a shotgun, and, you know, Henry Diltz, who seems all through this to be like a mayor of Laurel Canyon, as one of its longest living members there, you know, stops picking up hitchhikers because you don't know if that guy's going to slit your throat if you let him in your car. That's dramatic. That's not like that's not a casual change. That's not a little change. That is wholesale change in how these free-loving, free-thinking artists are living their life.
Yeah, they even commented on the fact that they used to keep their doors unlocked. I mean, it was just what you did. You know, you didn't think about it. You left your doors unlocked so in case your neighbor wanted to come by for a cup of coffee or to write a song, you just walk in. Everything was, you know, free and loving. And then times changed.
Yeah, and changed like really, really fast. It was interesting, Sheila, I want to talk to you about this. Jackson Browne talks about, at the beginning of this, you know, being a hippie, they were proud of it, you know, the idea of being a freak, being unapologetic for who you are, but that people in the country were anti-hippie, like they were defending themselves against the establishment. And then there's a news report during the Manson murders talking about the Sharon Tate murder, where they kind of like make the illusion that hippies are now armed and dangerous. You know, hippies are coming to kill you. You also see Michelle Phillips and John Phillips talking about how they moved out of Laurel Canyon to Bel Air. You know, they bought their really expensive cars and they totally sold out and not making apologies for it. And almost like a harbinger of what's to come. Did this documentary help inform your idea of hippie culture at this time?
I don't know. I mean, like, it's hard to define a hippie because after the Manson murders, there's a comment made. So one of the victims was actually a high school classmate of one of the members of the Turtles. And then the commentary was that now hippies after the Manson murders were seen as psycho killers, where, you know, up until this point, like, I mean, this happened the same month as Woodstock, which was all like flower child peace and love. And that's the view of hippies that like I have, you know, like they're, you know, chill. They're just,
they're too stoned to hurt.
Yeah.
You,
they just,
you
know? And they're just, you know, out to have a good time and, you know, just having fun and, you know, peace and love and all that good stuff. You know, I never equate the Manson clan, the Manson family, as being part of that hippie culture at all. Like it's very, to me, it's a very foreign land from where you would think of hippies. Like hippies, like even today, it's like you can't smile without saying, you know, when you say the word hippie, like you have to smile. Like they just a very unique group of people who, you know, they just wanted to have a good time and make music and make love and, you know, have fun. And so that to me did not equate, like, you know, people seeing hippies as psycho killers just does not compute to me.
Earlier at the top of this episode, Graham Nash is talking about how his time with Joni Mitchell and how Our House came to be as a song based on just a conversation, and it was literally ported into the lyrics of Our House. And he says that, you know, him and Joni for a time were the center of Laurel Canyon. They were this bubble of love. And then he comes back during the Manson murder section here, and he talks about how it just put a pin in the bubble. You know, and I think that's a really good metaphor of just watching this Garden of Eden really kind of dissipate. Let's take these guys though and move over to Altamont, because again, I think this is just another sign that things were changing, that the idea of making music because music's beautiful and free love and, you know, fuck who you want, smoke what you want, do what you want, was giving way to different concerns. I didn't know anything about Altamont other than knowing that it had been a concert and that the Rolling Stones were involved. I didn't know anything about it. John, as a musician, as a performing musician, does Altamont stand out to you as a festival like Monterey or Woodstock or any other famous music fest that's taken place in history?
To be honest, no. You know, I wasn't that knowledgeable of it, but it was good to learn about it, you know, in this documentary.
Oh, no, for sure. I mean, I don't know what the Stones are thinking, having the Hell's Angels run security. Right.
I did hear about that, but it was good to learn more about it.
Yeah, I mean, guy got stabbed to death right at the foot of the stage, right? Sheila, what was your take on this when David Crosby tells Chris Hellman, you know, as they're swapping spaces on stage and the Flying Burrito Brothers are coming out, and he tells him, you know, just watch yourself. And then he goes off to say, before the last bass note had finished, like, singing through the air, I had unplugged and I was getting the fuck out of there. What was your take on how they presented this whole scene here of Altamont?
You know, it was framed as, you know, the Rolling Stones answer to Woodstock. The quote that I wrote down, it was like the Vikings were ready to raid the monastery. This was about the Hell's Angels, like preying on the spectators. You could see how uncomfortable everybody was, even like talking about it, you know, 50 years later. It just made me uncomfortable to think that I go to so many concerts, I go to so many music events, I never think about my safety. Like, I'm just there to have a good time. Like, I don't think that, you know, I mean, I went to the last concert I went to before lockdown happened, had a mosh pit. I stayed the hell away from that because I'm too old for that shit. But at the same time, it's like, I never fear for my safety. So the fact that the musicians themselves felt unsafe, what happened here? What's happened to music? What's happened to the environment that this is, you know, seen as okay?
What did they think was going to happen? You know,
so I think that the Rolling Stones hiring the Hell's Angels was just bad management on whoever was managing them's part. I don't think the Rolling Stones had an active, you know, part to play in who did it. Or maybe they did because it would make good headlines. I don't know.
It was interesting. They really presented the Stones. They make a point of saying that they didn't know anything about Altamont, that they were visitors and they were barely visitors at that. When they put this thing together, it really doesn't reflect great on the Stones the way they're presented. Mm-mm. Here, coming into these Laurel Canyon people's kind of backyard and putting on this concert and they're being total outsiders. But yeah, real bad move on their part if they were just trying to compete with Woodstock, with the legacy of Woodstock, to put their name on it.
Yeah, this was like the, you know, the drunk friend that shows up late to the party trashing your house. That's kind of what that felt like to me.
The way they punctuate Altamont and then the Kent state riots taking place at the beginning of the 1970s, the 60s end, and with it, this idea of flower power and the peaceful hippie movement really ends in this dark moment and continues, and it really doesn't get much brighter. From here, we actually learn a bunch of things, and I'm going to ask you guys if you knew about it, because I didn't. If you had said that Bonnie Raitt and Linda Ronstadt, two people who I associate very heavily with country music, were fixtures in the folk rock and roll music scene of the early 1970s, what would you have said to someone who told you that Linda Ronstadt and Bonnie Raitt were part of that culture?
Shh, you lie. I never knew that Bonnie Raitt was like a California girl for any time in her life. I didn't really know enough about any of their backgrounds to know that they had lived in Laurel Canyon.
I guess that's the point, right? I mean, I know Linda Ronstadt from listening to her on the oldies radio station growing up, driving around in my parents' car. You know, I know Bonnie Raitt from like Bonnie Raitt now and Bonnie Raitt in like the late 90s and early 2000s and like a mature woman making great music, like country music that I really dig. You know, I didn't know anything about their background. So this was like a real revelation to me. John, what would you have said? I don't know how much of a fan you are of Bonnie Raitt and Linda Ronstadt to begin with, but what was your take on their importance in this second wave of Laurel Canyon?
I'm definitely a fan of both of them. I grew up and my parents used to play Linda Ronstadt all the time. So I'm quite familiar with her from a young age. I thought she was I think she is fantastic. But I didn't know the Laurel Canyon connection.
Another name who pops up right about this time is a guy some people may or may not have heard of. His name is David Geffen. He is a young music producer and rep at this point, working with Elliot Roberts. Elliot, we got to know pretty well in the first episode as being the manager, the early manager of a lot of these Laurel Canyon bands. So a very young David Geffen comes on the scene. Tim and Elliot Roberts start Asylum Records. Listen to this lineup of initial artists Asylum Records have. And this is not even who they eventually signed. I mean, they eventually had like Tom Waits and they had Bob Dylan. But at the start, Asylum Records, Joni Mitchell, Jackson Browne, Linda Ronstadt and the Stone Ponies, and Glenn Frey, and then eventually the Eagles. That's like part of their initial lineup. Not too shabby. Take a stab, Sheila, at how much David Geffen's net worth is approximately today.
Dude, I can't even begin to put a number on that. I mean, when they showed it was David Geffen, I'm like, dude, he's been around that long? I don't know. It's in the cajillions, I'd have to say.
And he's 77 now, so he was really super young at this point. So fast forward 50 years, add 50 years onto him. John, you want to take a guess at how much David Geffen is worth?
It's probably worth about $1 billion at this point.
Yeah, he's roughly worth about $8.4 billion.
Jesus. I was closer in my gajillions.
I think that says a lot about where Laurel Canyon, A Place in Time, the documentary, goes really from here on out, right? It really stops being about the music and becomes much more about the money and about making the money. I feel like $8.4 billion would have been repudiated by the initial people who lived in Laurel Canyon, right? I mean, that was why they lived there in the first place, because it was so cheap. You know, it was super close to the Sunset Strip and to the Troubadour, and it was ridiculously cheap. These people did not have $8.4 billion with them.
It kind of lost its charm. You know, in the beginning, it was a nice little community of musicians who used to write music during the day and then go watch each other at night. I won't say unfortunately, they all became very, very successful, but with that came a price. You know, you lose that charm. You know, now everyone's playing in arenas instead of intimate clubs. Everyone's making a gajillion dollars, and it changes people.
When Linda Ronstadt comes off stage, they're showing archival footage of her coming off stage at an arena show. And while they're showing it, she's talking about how everyone, you know, the Troubadour couldn't hold them anymore. They were too popular and they started playing arenas. And just like you said, when they started playing arenas, they stopped coming to each other's shows because they were all so busy and they were playing these mega shows. It wasn't intimate anymore. And I think you're exactly right. It lost the innocence, I think it had. It had the intimacy and the innocence that it had. Which is funny because Steve Martin is in this section, and who knew that Steve Martin dated Linda Ronstadt? That was shocking to me.
No idea.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, to see him with his banjo, I was like, oh my God, he was doing that in like 1970 and 1971. That's crazy. I had no idea. Also that his hair was already gray. Was he just always old?
That's what we said.
Yeah. I think he came out of the womb that way.
he gave a great quote. He says, you know, Laurel Canyon was not exclusive to wealth. It was exclusive to spirit. And then he makes a joke that he's like, I could never live here. And he's like, oh, yeah, I actually could, because it wasn't expensive. And I think that's such a great quote, but doesn't really seem to really fit for this second wave of Laurel Canyon. It seemed like it became much more about the wealth and much less about the spirit. Let's talk about drugs. Because, John, you made a great point that you were shocked at how creative they could all be with all the pot that they smoked. As a musician, and I'm sure, I mean, we all have an idea that musicians, you know, do crazy things in clubs, and we hear all the time about drug, sex, and rock and roll. Have you seen, like, firsthand accounts, friends or other people you know, or other musicians you've seen, what we're talking about here with Crosby, Stills, and Nash, the way cocaine, you know, the Peruvian darkness powder just ruined their abilities and their temperaments and their ability to create? Is that real life? Does that still happen today?
Unfortunately, I know it more than I care to say. I've seen it firsthand with a lot of very, very talented people that some people with so much talent got taken from us way too soon from it. You know, even in Laurel Canyon, you know, or Jimi Hendrix, they talked a little bit about. Yeah, I've seen it all too much.
It was really interesting watching them, Crosby, Stills, and Nash blow up. I don't remember who it was, but David Crosby was like laying in that hammock. One of his bandmates just laying him out, calling him like basically calling him like a piece of shit. And David Crosby looked so stoned. I'm not even sure he was realized that someone was actually talking to him when he was laying in the hammock. And it was amazing that they got that on camera, that was like filmed. Sheila, Graham Nash says that, you know, the drugs was like a false promise to them, not the pot. They really seem to think pot is separate from the cocaine, which is what they were really talking about in the harder drugs. And he talks about how they became colder, edgier, and they became less truthful. From what you saw here, does that hold a lot of water, or is that just like a convenient excuse for maybe other things that were happening?
I think it was like a confluence of events. I think the drugs got a little harder. With that comes the symptoms or the fallout from those, you know, those drugs. And the isolation, pot is just like a mellow drug. Like, so like pot, like we'll equate this to the hippies, right? Like it's peace and love. It's like, you're not going to do any damage when you do pot. But if you do something like cocaine, or you do, you know, I mean, they were tripping acid as well, but like, you know, more like cocaine, a stimulant, like it's a fuel for other things. So, you know, and, you know, the personality changes and things that come with it. But I think it was also parallel to the upheaval, the changes that were happening all around them, reality kind of knocking at their door. So I think it was just more like a hand in hand sort of down whatever the opposite of the yellow brick road would be.
This comes up all the time, and you know, we're covering over at the Clubhouse, we're covering Hollywood, and there's this recurring theme of, do people act the way they do because Hollywood is the way it is, or is Hollywood the way it is because of how people act? And what you just said made me think about that, though. Like, these were the kings and queens of the world, certainly within significant square footage of where they were located. So were drugs as popular and became as pervasive to the point that they had to do them? Or because they did them, did drugs become so pervasive and such a crutch for so many of them? You know, and musicians are temperamental and a lot of times very insecure. You know, it's a very heartfelt profession, and especially these kinds of artists where they're poets as much as they're musicians. You could see where maybe they were insecure, and so they felt maybe that they needed a crutch. But I don't know. John, what do you think? Is the drug use an excuse, or were they the ones making the drug culture what it was?
It's a good question. Not that easy to answer. I'm sure it's, you know, an individual basis. Being a songwriter, a lot of the artists in Laurel Canyon also brought this up, that sometimes either pot or acid opens their creative mind, opens their view. So I think insecurity plays a part in it too. It's very individual. Some use it as a crutch. Some use it as inspiration.
And some people just really like it, probably. You know, yeah. There's always people who just like, fuck it. I like to not feel anything at any time ever.
You know, there's also, unfortunately, like this very pervasive streak of, I don't know if it's depression. Like there's lulls that artists get. You know, like we've seen kind of a wash of suicides in the last couple of years. You know, like Robin Williams being an artist, Chris Cornell. So, you know, there's been a lot, you know, of this, you know, recently that have been, you know, kind of struck people. But, you know, going all the way back into this documentary, like Graham Nash you know, said that Joni Mitchell would go into lulls and he would give her space when she went into the void and things like that. The innate nature of some artists is to have, you know, tendency to, I guess they have like more addictive personality. So drugs kind of fuel, you know, maybe whatever they don't like in themselves, or maybe it fuels their creativity.
Yeah, I would agree with that also.
It's funny you brought up Robin Williams, and this is a total tangent, but I was really, you know, there's been, like you said, there's been a rash of celebrity suicides and overdoses, and it's always sad, you know, that someone feels so alone, no matter how much money they have or how much fame or
how they're loved.
And none of that gets through to them or it can't save them. And there have been a couple that have affected me, and Robin Williams was one that really got to me because he was just a formative part of like my childhood, and a lot of what I consider funny comes from him and watching him. And I was playing for Tom the other day. I played him clips from Good Morning Vietnam. We were listening to the Good Morning Vietnam soundtrack, and they have all the Adrian Cronauer bits from the movie on that soundtrack. And all of it still made me laugh. And it made Tom laugh, who had never heard it before. He's 12, he's precocious, he's right on that puberty edge. And he was laughing his ass off at it. And it's still so funny today. And then I played him live at the Met, Robin Williams live at the Met. It just so funny. And it's
just magical.
Magical, and someone so talented. And you see it here with like Jim Morrison, the music that they created, or just the reckless lives that they lived, the way they mistreated themselves, and they couldn't appreciate and love themselves enough. It just couldn't get through to them. It's heartbreaking. It really is.
Like, we can tell you exactly where we were and what we were doing when we heard that Robin Williams died. It just stabbed us in the heart.
Yeah. I mean, Robin Williams and Tom Petty was the other one too. You know, Tom Petty again was a big part of.
Oh, Tom Petty was devastating. Sorry for being on a tangent, but like after Tom Petty died, I decided, I was like, you know what? I need to go see all my old men that I love in concert before they're all gone.
No, I mean, it's important. I saw Neil Diamond 2 years ago, finally. I'd always wanted to see a Neil Diamond in concert. I was like, how much longer am I going to have? I love Neil Diamond.
So do I.
I have no shame about that. And he's fantastic.
He's great.
I mean, he doesn't dance so great anymore. Not that I think he ever danced really well. But, you know, the songs are a little bit slower, but Cracklin' Rose, he still crackles.
Yeah.
You know, I was loving it.
Neil Diamond wrote I'm a Believer.
Made famous by the Monkees.
The Monkees made it famous, but that was Neil Diamond writing that. Before he became, you know, the artist of Neil Diamond, he was just a songwriter. He had to pay the mortgage, absolutely. And he did.
I love it. Could put that right in the drawer with I Didn't Realize Jackson Browne wrote Taking It Easy. When he starts singing it with that disgusting mustache and he starts singing Taking It Easy at the end here, I was like, wow, he does a really good cover of that song. And then they're like, well, yeah, he wrote it, but he couldn't finish it. So he gave it to Glenn Frey and Don Henley to finish. I was like, what? What?
That was my jaw drop moment for this documentary.
You know, I know Linda Ronstadt Desperado version, but I didn't realize they needed her to record it and make it famous for their album version to become a hit. Like, that was shocking to me, you know, because I only know it now with both the versions exist, and I just assumed that both of them were hits because they're both great versions. You know, it was shocking to me to learn that it was a flop out of the gate until she picked it up.
Right, like I didn't know it was a contemporary cover.
Right, well, and did it on stage with them, like with their blessing and like their thank you so much, Linda, for helping us out here. You know, for using your star power to help us. And that actually segues us perfect here, because like I said, we're getting towards the end of this time. We're getting towards the end of the idyllic paradise that was this Laurel Canyon community. Jim Ladd in this, by the way, if Nurit and Henry Diltz and Elliot Roberts were really the narrators of part one, I think Jim Ladd really is the voice of part two. And he comes back and he talks about how in Laurel Canyon, the pathos of Laurel Canyon was basically it was always more important to make the music than make money. And it's perfect because he says that, and then he introduces Glenn Frey. They talk about him as always wanting to be a rock star. He was the anti-Laurel Canyon pathos. He wanted to just be fucking rich and fucking famous, and however he had to do it, to do it. It almost struck me like it was almost like a virus that invaded the community. Is that too much, Sheila? Am I being too dramatic there?
So that pathos, that desire that Glenn Frey kind of came in with, the documentary ran with that notion where, you know, there's a quote from Don Henley where he says that success is scarier than failure, Whereas that is the complete opposite of where we were for the first part of this documentary, where it was like, hey, we just made enough money to pay the rent. This is great. So it was definitely two ends of the spectrum here. So I don't think that you're being, I don't think you're far off the mark at all when you say that.
John, what's your take on the Eagles? I'm a fan of theirs, but I don't like them really personally. So I think it affects my like of their music a little bit. I mean, their classics are Stone Cold classics, and I'll always listen to them. But Don and Glenn have just come off as such whiny little bitches over the years with their squabbles.
Sure. What happens is, before success hits, you know, everything is all for one and one for all. And then it seems like, you know, the money factor comes in, they get really successful, and then they start arguing about whose songs make it on the record. Egos come into play. It's like a relationship, any relationship. You know, I remember hearing stories about when their first records came out, Don Henley and Glenn Frey just wanted to kill each other.
A lot of the bands that we saw in this documentary that formed and then fell apart and then reformed all happened really organically. It was, I left this band, you know, I left the Byrds, and then I wandered into this guy's house in Laurel Canyon, and we started making music together, and then we started a band. It was really organic. The Eagles were like kind of how like boy bands are assembled. You know, it wasn't organic. It was basically everyone telling, it was Linda Ronstadt and David Geffen telling Glenn Frey, you've got talent and you've got star power, but you are not good enough on your own to make it. So you need a singing drummer, check. You need a great bassist, check. You know, you need Randy Meisner, check. It was like music by numbers. It wasn't organic music. And I think maybe that was the issue. What you're saying is right about the squabbling right from the get-go. But you look at like Stephen Stills, right? There's this part where they're talking about, Crosby, Stills, and Nash are talking about how they were doing solo sets, or they were doing songs that they all wrote in like sets. You know, they would each take two songs. And then when Stephen Stills' turn to go and he realizes Dylan's in the audience listening to them, he played five of his songs. And the band was furious at him. Graham Nash was, you know, wanted to like rip his throat out. But then got off stage and they played the best set that they ever played after the intermission. And he was like, I couldn't be mad at him. The music was so good, I couldn't stay mad at him for his selfishness. Glenn Frey and Don Henley are the reverse of that. They never found an opportunity to not be mad at each other over their selfishness.
Yeah, I mean, the Eagles used to fight so much that when they broke up, they said, you know, the next time they tour will be when hell freezes over. Fast forward 25, 30 years, whatever it was, and they were like, oh, need to pay the mortgage again. Let's get it back together. Hell freezes over.
Right. I mean, I think their entire section, when they talk about the making of their second album as a concept album, as the Desperados dressed like cowboys and stuff, and they were all puffing their chest about how they all saw themselves as these outlaws, these real, like bad
guitar
boys.
Gunslingers. Going from city to city.
Which has such a poser feel to it. You know, it's, you got the original, you have these original Laurel Canyon people, right, who are doing it and who are making it a scene, right? It wasn't a scene before they were there. And then you have these, like, posers. You know, you have Crosby, Stills, and Nash. You know, they're taking a picture for their cover album outside of a dilapidated house about to be bulldozed. The Eagles are dressing up like cowboys and prancing around for their cover art. I don't know that they could have been more opposite. What did you think, John? Were you turned off by like the calculatedness of the Eagles and like their kind of rise to fame that we see here?
Sure, sure. I think Don Henley said it best years later when he did his solo album and he wrote "The End of the Innocents." You know, I think that you know, that would be a great theme song for, you know, what happened. I'm not saying that's what he wrote it about. I'm just saying it, you know, it fits. It's always said, you know, if you look at any band, any artist out there, usually their first record, there's something about their first record that is so organic and so real. It's really hard to duplicate that. You know, when they become, let's say their first album takes off and they try to duplicate that with their second record, success plays, I believe it plays a big role in the writing and the creativity. There's an organic nature to that first record when they were just doing it from their soul instead of, is this next song a hit or not? And I think it does. It plays a big part in it.
They talked about like the vortex of success and how do you need to keep feeding the machine. So I think that plays right to what you were just saying. And they don't know that first album's going to make it. So it is coming from a much more pure place.
You know, and just the idea that camaraderie gives way to chasing success. No longer sharing tunes. The idea of sharing songs. Like, oh, you know, this isn't in my range. This isn't in my key. You know, you should go do this song. To everyone guarding it because maybe it's their next big hit and they don't want to. They don't want to share that secret, that sharing. Like that's a real underlying pathos that disappeared. It really evaporated over the course of this 2.5 hours that we watched this music doc.
I think that's why John Lennon and Paul McCartney had the best idea. You know, they said, okay, I'm going to write songs, you're going to write songs, and we'll put them together. What comes of it? Each song comes of it. It's all for one. And I think that is the best recipe.
And they made a gajillion dollars.
Did they ever?
So Laurel Canyon, A Place in Time, ends really on two sad notes, both of which really, I think, drive home the idea that this place in time had come to a close. We go back to the Doors, which we spent some time with in part one and a little bit in the beginning of this part two. But towards the end here, we have a nice section where Robbie Krieger and Ray Masaryk talk about Jim and the last days of his life and how his drinking had increased. But then they came together for the LA Woman sessions. As they finished the album, he tells, I think it was Ray, or no, it was Robbie. He says, you know, I'm going to go to Paris. And the band was happy for him. They were like, go, clear your head. You know, remember you're a poet again. Get yourself cleaned up. You know, get out of this scene. It'll be good for you. Never came home and died at 27 and a half years old, they say. He eulogizes his friend here at the end. As a big Doors fan, I found this really, I didn't cry, but I was probably as close to actual like emotion as I get in these kinds of things here. What did you think, Sheila, you know, as this 1-2 punch? Because then we talk about Cass Elliot after this.
As we talked about in the first episode, I was kind of like a teenager when I kind of discovered these bands. And, you know, the Doors was a very big part of, you know, my mid-teenage years, you know, being an angsty teenager. Yeah, when I learned that, you know, Jim Morrison died and stuff like that, you know, way back then, it was sad because I'm like, oh my God, like this guy is just so talented. But now to see, you know, sort of the lead up, like, you know, where they came from nothing. And they were the ones who were so excited when like their first album was portrayed as a billboard in Los Angeles. And they were just like, we can finally pay the rent. You know, to go from that, you know, level of just starting out and like, you know, what John said, so organic. And then, you know, going to like where Jim Morrison was described as incandescent and burning. So, yeah, seeing where he kind of ended up was kind of sad for me. Like that was really for me the bottom of this emotionally.
Seeing him in a like a fetal position singing on the stage, part of me was very impressed that he was able to sing still as well as Jim Morrison can sing in that position.
How strong his voice was.
Holy shit, right? But also, my heart was breaking for him because, again, you see things like this in The Doors, which I love. The Doors is a great movie. It's one of my favorite like rock music movies, you know, movies about a musician. But you think that has to be heightened or exaggerated for a movie effect. But this was real footage that we're watching in this documentary of him, you know, writhe around on the stage in almost like a fetal position as the police decide whether or not they're going to arrest him. And then he does get arrested for the threatening to take out his cock. What did you think, John? Again, and you bring a perspective to it because you play with musicians, you see all sorts of personalities. What is seeing like a Jim Morrison and that kind of decline? If you see that, is that all red flags for you? Or do you just chalk it up to, that's how Jim is?
Look. He laid the platform for future rock stars. Would that raise a red flag with me? Yes and no. People want that mysterious bad boy front man. I mentioned it in last episode. The mysterious rock star, the Kurt Cobain, to bring a contemporary aspect to it. People want that. It's a selling point. It's think of the Doors without Jim Morrison, without that persona. He was a big draw to the Doors. Yeah. That mysteriousness, that bad boy-ish.
It's sexy.
It sells.
It's something, you know, I think people, especially couch sitters, you know, like armchair quarterbacks, look at your Kurt Cobains. They look at your Eddie Vedders, your Michael Stipes, your Jim Morrisons, you know, these really moody artists that front these massive bands. It's easy to sit back and be like, God, you know, they're so stuck up. Like, what kind of problems can they possibly have? They have it all. Like, they're millionaires. They're beloved by screaming fans everywhere. God, the one girl trying to jump in the limo to get into Jim Morrison's lap, you know, as they're pulling up to the club. You know, Ray and Robbie talk about the fact that as Jim became more and more the face of the Doors, the burden was just crushing him. The responsibility and the weight of being in that spotlight, whether you asked for it or not. The result of it is just, it's got to be so soul crushing, you know, kind of like how we talk about Robin Williams. I don't know that you could ever really appreciate the coping that they have to do with alcohol or drugs to get through those days, especially if you have a sensitive poet's soul. You know, if you're equipped maybe to be a party boy anyway, and it's all good, you know, it's just more of what you already like. But if at your core, you're just like the sensitive poet, I don't know that people really ever fully appreciate the burden that those celebrities go through.
I agree. I'm not a famous artist or anything like that, but I am a songwriter. And many times, admittedly, I have drank a good amount to try to use that as inspiration to put me in a different state of mind. If it worked or not is irrelevant, you know, but anything to help the creativity.
And you have a sensitive poet soul.
I do. I admit.
Well, I think it kind of comes hand in hand. I mean, it's hard to make music that is going to move someone in any way beyond the surface. You know, real music that moves you in your soul comes from someone who wrote it in as genuine and as sincere a way, right? It's hard to fake sincerity. So I think you need a poet's soul in order to make the most memorable kinds of tracks. The final aspect here is, and this was like a real, was shown to us as being kind of the lost soul of the Canyon, was the death of Mama Cass. Now, the Mamas and the Papas played a big part in part one, but they were kind of just more in the background here. You know, Michelle Phillips talks about how her and John got off and you know, became part of the establishment. They totally sold out, and she, you know, didn't seem very apologetic about it. You know, we were hippies that became the establishment. But Mama Cass stayed. She stayed in the Canyon. She was described as a queen of the Canyon. You know, they interview her daughter here. And she was like a mentor, especially for all these second wave Laurel Canyon denizens. Sheila, did this resonate with you in any way? I guess if you're not a Mamas and Papas fan or a Mama Cass fan, maybe it doesn't hold a lot of resonance. But what was your take on this section of the film as it represented kind of the end of Laurel Canyon as we knew it, or as we had been shown it?
I mean, it was sad because, I mean, I knew she was young and she was like 33 years old. I didn't know that she had such a young daughter, you know, so that's sad. I liked how they portrayed her in the second part of the documentary because, you know, she was known to bring acts back into Laurel Canyon to like come and hang out. So Eric Clapton, she like picked him up in the club and was like, hey, come on back. You know, someone who's like the kind of like that heart and soul, you know, that was kind of the death knell for me. It was like, and then, you know, obviously they were getting to the end of it anyway, but it was just like the way that they kind of put her death in the timeline of the show. It was just, you know, like we're reaching the end of something good here.
How about you, John? What was your take on the Mama Cass being the end of here versus the end of Laurel Canyon as we had seen it the last 2 hours?
Yeah. You know, she was a symbol of Laurel Canyon. You know, as Sheila said, I really liked the fact that she tried to help the quote-unquote next wave of artists coming out. But in regards to her death, obviously at that age, it's tragic. Anyway, you caught it. But it kind of put a period, you know, to the Laurel Canyon sentence, the end of an era.
Yeah, I mean, for sure. I mean, we go back to Nurit and Henry, our two photographers who lived and walked among all of these Laurel Canyon people as it happened. And they go back to them for Mama Cass. And, you know, Nurit talks about how it just wasn't the same anymore. And Henry says that the loss of Mama Cass basically was like a hole in the soul left in Laurel Canyon. And it was a real bookend to the end of this story. It's hard to pinpoint when something starts, and it's hard to pinpoint when something ends. And even the beginning isn't so clear. If you go back to the beginning of part one, it happened so organically, no one realized it was happening when Laurel Canyon was becoming this destination for artists. This seemed very much like a very specific ending. And that's where we do, in fact, end it. Just a little footnote. I don't know if you guys caught that the film was dedicated in memory to Elliot Roberts, who actually died while they were filming this last year. Well, I think they filmed it over 2018 and 19, but he died while they were filming this in 2019. So I thought it was nice that they dedicated the film to him at the end.
I would love to know if they knew how special the situation was that they were in, if they took it for granted, or if they said, wow, how fortunate are we to just be in this paradise that we're in right now?
You know, I think I thought about that too. And Joni Mitchell, she broke up with Graham Nash with a telegram, I think he says. And in it, she said something like, if you hold the sand too tight, it slips through your fingers. And I thought that was kind of a metaphor for Laurel Canyon. To answer your question, my impression was, if they had realized how monumental and important it was, it probably would have evaporated quicker. Because just the same way that they stopped seeing each other's shows because they couldn't play in the Troubadour anymore, as soon as you became aware of the thing, I think the thing probably would have disappeared. That was my take anyway. How about you, Sheila? What's your answer to John's question?
Hindsight's 20/20. They didn't know what they had until it changed. And then you look back and you're like, oh, we had it all for just a brief moment. And this was basically like a 10-year period between, you know, 65 and 75. But I think if they had coined it earlier or given it a name earlier, it wouldn't have worked. It wouldn't have been as, you know, seamless and as magical and as organic as it really kind of was shown in this documentary.
I mean, to quote Big Yellow Taxi, right? You don't know what you've got until it's gone. And then they pave paradise and Glenn Frey puts up a parking lot. So, you know, this is a review and it's a little bit of our like love it or leave it kind of feel to it. John, give people listening your 30-second elevator pitch. Now all said and done, should people be tuning into or finding some way to watch this Epic's original music documentary, Laurel Canyon, Place and Time?
Oh, I definitely think not only if you're a fan of that music, if you're a fan of any sort of creativity, if you love music or you love art, any of the arts, I think this is actually a very important documentary to watch. How, you know, it was a place and time with special people. Thankfully, they made something pretty great out of it. You know, it could have went the other way. They could have all OD'd, but they didn't. They built a musical era. Definitely tune in and check it out. I think they'll love it.
You know, we're about 50 years removed from sort of the height of Laurel Canyon. And I have to say that a lot of these songs are played today. They do find their way regularly onto my Spotify streaming service. Where else are you going to find that Bonnie Raitt moved into Laurel Canyon, into Harry Houdini's house where Frank Zappa also lived, and that Steve Martin, who would open up for Linda Ronstadt so that, you know, he could be like the placeholder until the drugs kicked in. As a fan of music, that this is such an important thing to watch, because you just learn so much about how things came about and just a more innocent place and time where music was really allowed to be music and it wasn't material. It wasn't, you know, a construct of the vortex of the recording companies. This was like the last like age of innocence, like John said earlier.
In the movie Devil Wears Prada, Meryl Streep has this whole line, this whole monologue about cerulean and how the blue sweater Anne Hathaway is wearing. Anne Hathaway thinks, in her naive youngness, thinks that she picked that blue sweater and she made a choice. And Meryl Streep goes to this whole monologue about how that's not blue, it's not turquoise, it's not lapis, it's cerulean blue. And that it was picked by people at a fashion show several years ago. And it made its way through runway shows. And from the runway shows, it made its way to other design houses. And from there, it made its way, the color made its way into knockoff designers who make mass-produced clothing that you'll buy at Target or Walmart or, you know, at a store in the mall.
She calls it a bargain basement.
And the idea that what you think you have now was just created by you in this moment is such a misunderstanding of how things really are. Was kind of how I felt about Laurel Canyon. You know, I had a vague notion of this kind of music and how important a time this was for music. But Laurel Canyon for me was important, like John said. It was educational, but it really shines a light on a fundamentally important time in American music. And American music and the way music is understood as a place in the history of this country. Because music really was a soundtrack behind the events of the 60s and the 70s, you know, and the Vietnam era and the protests and the civil rights movement. Music is a backdrop to that. People walk through Walmart. They walk through Kmart. So much of this music I heard tonight on the soundtrack was songs that I heard every day when I worked at Kmart for 5 years. And it was just a soundtrack to my life in the mid-90s. But it was music that was created and was cutting edge and it was transformative 30 years before that, 40 years before that. And this is where it started. This is literally where it started. It was this documentary takes you from this pre-rock and roll period through the birth of rock and roll and then the decline of that first wave of it. And I can't stress enough how useful and important and informative this is. But it's also just tells a great story. Even if you don't like music, I think you would like Laurel Canyon, A Place in Time, because it tells such an interesting story that happens to also be true. John, Sheila, thank you guys so much for spending the last couple hours with us talking about this. It's always fun to have new people come to the clubhouse and talk to us and mix up our voices. But it was a real pleasure having you guys share this place and time with me. So thank you guys so much.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you.
Really appreciate it.
Our pleasure.
And guys out there listening, thank you so much for listening. I hope you go check out this Epic's original documentary, Laurel Canyon, A Place in Time. Part 1 comes out on May 31st at 10 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. And Part 2 comes out on June 7th at 10 o'clock Eastern Standard Time. Find Epic's wherever your cable provider has it. Thank you for listening to Pod Clubhouse. And thank you for listening to Pod Clubhouse Film Reviews. And we'll talk to you soon. Thanks so much.
Thank you for listening. This has been an original Pod Clubhouse production. Pod Clubhouse is a podcast network dedicated to encouraging collaboration among podcasters and friends to bring a fresh voice and diverse perspective on a wide array of content. Please visit and leave a comment for us at podclubhouse.com. Rate, review, and subscribe to our podcast feeds on Apple Podcasts. Follow us on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook. You can find us at Pod Clubhouse. Our DMs are always open, and we'd love to hear from you.